maybe
go
over
ahead.
The Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It's Monday, May 16th, 2011, and we have four items on our agenda, and we are going to reverse the order because Senator Ingebertson has a conference committee he must get to, and he is number four and is promising a very quick bill, and so we will be taking up what is on the agenda as Senate File 1002, but it has been recently passed by the House, so it is now House File 1011. And so, Senator Ingebertson on House File 1011.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for sliding up on the schedule here. This is a trout stamp, trout and salmon stamp, as you can see on the bill. And I'm going to let Commissioner Meyer explain exactly what it is.
Commissioner Meyer.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This bill before you is pretty simple. We have many different stamp accounts that are, in the past, they have been statutorily appropriated. We have to adjust these every year, every biennium after that, once those dollars are set in statute. People paid for the trout salmon stamp for the privilege of harvesting trout and salmon within the state. All we're asking for here is that give us the authority to spend these dollars in the account as they're in there. So it actually makes it a direct appropriation rather than coming back and coming through the annual budget cycle. Every budget cycle, every biennium, we have to come in and adjust or lower the amount that's in these dollars. We can't spend these dollars. Are spent. You can see from lines 1.11 through 2.1, it specifically states what these dollars are eligible to be used for. We also have a budget oversight committee that is watching over these appropriations very closely, making sure that we're spending these dollars only on the appropriate sources. So this just gives us a little bit more flexibility on our end, and it reduces the burden on your end of having to adjust these numbers every year.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, you don't have like $5.2 billion hanging around, do you, in those accounts?
Still shy.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, no, sir.
How much is in the, what are we talking?
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, it's probably, I don't have my budget numbers with me, $500,000-$600,000 to $1 million, depending on the number of stamps that we sell. And that's part of the problem because we estimate a number, like in Senator Ingebertson's finance bill, we estimate what the number might be over the next 2 years. Then we have to come back and actually rectify that number versus the number of stamps that we actually sell. So it just depends on any given year who's buying the stamps and things like that.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the House and the Senate bills because they're both in our packet. And the Senate bill isn't effective until July 1st of 2 years from now? And the House bill is this year? When is Senator Ingebertson, is there a financial reason you wanted to move it out 2 years? Or is it just goofy?
Commissioner Meyer, I do think that is correct. The House language is for 2011, and the Senate is later.
Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure how that actually happened, but we would appreciate the earlier date rather than the later date.
Which is the House file?
That's right.
The earlier.
Yes. So we do want the House file language then.
Yes.
Well, we could just amend ours to be, you know, the last word becomes 2011 as well. Because I think they're identical other than that.
Well, we do have to work off the House file.
Off the House file? Okay.
Yeah. So if that's what we want, then that's in good shape. And I just wanted to announce we do have a quorum. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there... if we were to agree to this, is there ever an accounting that would be coming forward that would tell the legislature, you know, what you're spending the money on, et cetera?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Newman, yes, and I thank you for bringing that point up. We do submit, or actually our Budget Oversight Committee submits an annual report to the chairs of the House and Senate Environment Finance Committees and the minority members as well on what our expenditures are, and they also provide recommendations on what we should or shouldn't be doing in there as well. So there's another layer beyond the legislative branch that's looking at this spending as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do any members have any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against House File 1011? If not, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, I would move House File 1011 to pass.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that House File 1011 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor for general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Next, we will have up Senate File 1042, which is Senator Wieger's bill relating to driver's education instruction and license examination requirements expansion for carbon monoxide poisoning. Welcome, Senator Wieger.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 1042 addresses driver's education testing requirements specifically for carbon monoxide. The bill is also inspired by Tyler Lavers, who lost his life as a victim of carbon monoxide poisoning. His mother's here and family. I just want to acknowledge them here in the room. They've been at every part of the journey and the other body as well in the Senate at hearings, and policy-wise, it has always been unanimous. We're here to look at the fiscal note, which you have before you. It's $44,000 for the implementation for the driver's manual and instruction component. Ms. McCormick's here from the department, and I would yield for any questions you'd have of me or of the department.
Ms. McCormick, did you want to come forward? Welcome, Ms. McCormick. Do members have questions about the fiscal note? If you look on the back side on page 2, you'll see what they're expecting the cost to be for this. I did note, however, that in the bill it does say that they would not be having to change the manuals except anything that would be printed after August 1st of this year. I don't know how often you reprint them, but it would not affect any new printing. And in fact, I'm thinking the intention here is that as they reprint, the changes would be made in the newly reprinted manuals. Is that correct, Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. Madam Chair, we are moving to an online driver's manual, and part of the reason for that is because we want to be able to be more current with the information that we're providing rather than only printing them once a year. We're working on that plan right now, and so we would certainly be able to print information and keep that information updated. And we have reached out to the family to ask if they would like to submit some information that we could work with in terms of putting that in the manual, because I know they've had some suggestions. And so the fiscal note here refers to the testing that we do. We do computerized testing at our larger stations, but we also have smaller stations where they may only be open one or 2 days a week or a month, and at those stations they use paper and pencil. And so we have to reprint the tests, but not the manuals. I think the way it's written here, it talks about a manual test, and so I think a lot of people, because of the questions I've been getting, are reading it that's the manual, but it's actually just a paper and pencil test, so that at our smaller offices, they because of the costs associated with the computers for testing, they just use paper and pencil tests. So the majority of the costs in this fiscal note relate to the fact that we have a contract with a vendor who provides the test software for the computerized tests, and anytime we make a change to that test, there's a certain cost that's part of our contract. And so that's part of the costs, as well as each of the questions needs to be translated into the five other languages other than English that are used at the on the computer tests. And so those are what the costs are related to. There will be exempt rulemaking that's required, because if we require something to be part of driver education, we have to submit rules to in order to do that. So those are basically the costs for the that are listed on the fiscal note.
Mr. Carmack, this would normally come from the driver and vehicle special fund that is raised through driver's license fees. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that would be correct. It'd be the driver services special revenue account.
And Ms. McCormick, how healthy or unhealthy does that fund currently look?
Well, Madam Chair, we DVS operates on the appropriation that we receive through the budget process from our special revenue account, and so there certainly is some balance. I don't have the exact numbers with me today, but there is some balance in the special revenue account. Obviously, for some of the costs, we try to be to operate as a fee-based operation. Some of these costs, I think, are the cost of doing normal business within the division. But when we get to rulemaking, those costs usually are outside of what we may normally have within our budget. But otherwise, there would be money from the special revenue account that could be appropriated, or else we'll find money in our budget to do it, and we may not be able to do some other things as a result.
And members, what happens sometimes if we deplete their funds too much, then they come and ask for a fee increase, of course. I don't know if we're at that point. That's what I was kind of asking about, because typically these issues are covered by that special revenue fund. And so I do think there's probably adequate funding in there right now, but it depends upon what other demands they have on that fund, too. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think it's a small price to pay. I lost a cousin in the same thing when he was 18 years old.
It is an important issue.
It's a small price to pay. We should do it. Thanks. Thanks, Chuck, for
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Wigger, for bringing it forward. When I was growing up, my mom would just tell us this all the time about, you know, you could die from carbon monoxide, and she really scared us. And I have watched with my own children that they don't have that fear. And so just this past winter, I heard my our youngest child in the garage with his car on, and I went running out there screaming at him. And he said, well, the garage door's open. And I screamed, it doesn't matter. Get out quickly. And it was very frightening. And so I realized that they are not being trained properly. And so I, too, am very grateful that you're bringing this forward. And I'm so sorry for the family's loss.
I know there was a letter in the packet that Tyler's family put together from another mother who had a similar story about her son. She had asked him to go out and warm up the car, and he had the door down, and she got there in time, but she said he had just gotten his license and he had no knowledge or training in it. And so this is a very important piece of educational information that our young people need to learn as soon as they start running cars. It's very important, and we thank the family for bringing this, and we do extend our sympathy to you for your loss. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Higgins would like to move Senate file. I got to find the number again.
1042.
Is there any other questions, or is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? If not, Senator Higgins renews her motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 1042 will be placed on general orders.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for your support, for sharing a bit of your personal lives. We can all identify with some episodes, and mostly to Tyler and to his family that's here. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Our next bill up will be Senate File 1260, Senator Cruz. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Before you today, we have Senate File 1260, which is a mandate relief bill for our cities and counties here in Minnesota. I would, before we get started, like to offer a quick amendment. If somebody could please offer the A9 amendment for me.
Senator Perry offers the A9 amendment, which is being distributed.
Essentially what this amendment does, Madam Chair and members, we are going to take out Section 1 of the bill, which is the driving force behind the fiscal note that you see in front of you. So to kind of move this along, being that we're at the end of session here, we're going to take that out. And then that also corrects just a quick error that happened in the revisor's office as they were translating this.
All right, so are there any questions on the A9 amendment as explained by Senator Cruz?
Yes.
We are deleting Section 1 and making some other technical correction. Any questions? If not, all in favor of adopting the A9? Senator Higgins?
I'm sure there's something besides deleting Section 1 on there, and it has to do with Section 7, the collective bargaining section, and I'd like to hear about that as well.
Is that on page 4?
It's line 3 of the amendment and page 4 of the bill, and I just haven't had time to engross it, so apologize, but maybe you can tell us what that is, Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, that was a mistake that was made in the revisor's office as they were translating this, and Madam Chair was actually the one that made the amendment in local government that worded it this way. There was some back and forth about which language to use, and the revisor accidentally put in the wrong language. So this is a technical correction to that.
But Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, it changes it quite a bit, I believe. So it might be technical, but it's... I'm wondering the actual effect.
Senator Higgins, I do recall this happened in local government and elections, and it was an amendment that we were working on for some time, trying to reach a compromise, and I did move to use the language to the extent, and it was adopted, and so it is unusual that unless showed up, because that had earlier been been discussed earlier, but it is not what was adopted.
Okay. So Madam Chair, I think the effect of it would be that if the aggregate value of the benefits is in the collective bargaining agreement, then this section is in effect, or does this mean that this aggregate value of benefits then needs to become part of the collective bargaining? Or I guess I'm just trying to figure out the effect.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I would say you are right in that assessment. The goal of this legislation is to try and ease some of those burdens on our cities and on our counties. This was a very, very much good faith effort to come to some compromise language, and this is what was decided on in the local government committee.
And Madam Chair, I don't want to belabor it, but I see we have some labor representatives in the room. Can you tell me if this was what y'all agreed to? A nod, a shake, Anything?
Senator
Higgins. Oh, there's a lot of no's.
Senator
on this.
Higgins, it was not necessarily what everyone wanted, but the committee did vote on this language.
Okay, we'll talk about it in a bit then.
Okay, back to the amendment, the A9 amendment, and we can discuss the bill after we adopt the amendment. All in favor of the A9 amendment as moved by Senator Perry, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. The motion did prevail. And now back to the bill, Senator Cruz. And we have removed, I understand, the fiscal portion of it, but as is the custom here, we do like to have an understanding of the entire bill. And so if you could give us a summary of what is in the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We are prepared to do that. With me today, I have Keith Carlson of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and I also have Laura Kushner, the Human Resources Director for the League of Minnesota Cities, to kind of walk you through the bill.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director, and I will just quickly run through the bill after the amendment. The current Section 2, in conjunction with the repeal of 279.07 and 279.08 in the last section of the bill, basically eliminates the obligation for counties to annually entertain bids for publication of the delinquent tax list and designate a newspaper for that purpose. They still can go through that if they want to, but if they want to retain the prior years or use the same newspaper as publishes their minutes, this would be permitted with these changes. Section 3, in conjunction with the repealer of 340A.414, subdivision 1A, also back in the last section, basically eliminates a report from cities, counties to the Department of Public Safety of 3.2 malt beverage licensees. Section 4 is basically technical. It's the publication statute, and instead of referring to individual sections, it just refers to the entire statute. Section 5 has some minor substance to it. County boards are required to annually or whenever they change it, publish the compensation or per diem of their county commissioners. But not only do they publish it once in their official or legal newspaper, they are required under current law to publish a second time in another newspaper. This eliminates the second publication. Madam Chair, then Section 6 of the bill before amendment is just a change affecting Ramsey County Community Corrections. Right now in the county statute, they have a list that basically duplicates general law in spelling out the duties of their community corrections department that basically provides probation and supervised release services to individuals who have been convicted of various crimes. Section 7, we've already briefly discussed, and I'll be happy to give some additional testimony, but has... just very quickly, basically, has amended. This provides that once existing collective bargaining agreements have expired, then to the extent the unions want to provide that there can't be any reduction in those benefits in the future, they have to explicitly have agreed in the collective bargaining agreement as to whatever provisions they want specified during the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. So if they want to spell out the provider, they want to spell out the deductibles, they want to spell out the copays, it's incumbent upon them during the future collective bargaining agreement to do that. Right now, they don't have to go through any effort to explicitly spell that out under this provision before the amendment. Section 8, then, is the repealer. I've already gone through the first three. 382.265 is what's known as the clerk hire provision, where a county official who feels that he or she's been shortchanged in the budget for his office can appeal to the county board for additional funding, which frankly, since the county board established the budget in the first place, is a somewhat superfluous process and never has occurred in recent memory to my knowledge. 383A404, again, is the explicit duties of the Ramsey County Community Corrections Office that is now replaced by Section 6. All the references to 395 various sections are an archaic weed or seed and feed program where back during and prior to the Depression, counties could make loans to farmers to acquire seed and feed, and obviously hasn't been used for a number of years. With that, Madam Chair, I am prepared to testify a little bit further on Section 7, if that's the committee's desire.
I understand there are some questions about it. Senator Higgins, did you want Mr. Carlson to explain it further?
Because what Mr. Carlson said doesn't seem to match the words that are in this subdivision. So I'm kind of confused. This subdivision does not talk. Let me see it once more. It doesn't talk about an expiration of the contract, which you talked about, Mr. Carlson. And I think I'd like to have some folks from our unions talk about whether this kind of thing is actually in their collective bargaining agreement. Because I don't think everybody probably has. I will guarantee not every contract is includes the same items, and I'm really wondering how many have this kind of a thing that they bargain for. And I see several people here give us some information.
And Senator Higgins, this is new because the original language is what you see that is not underlined.
Yes.
And in the original bill, this whole section was going to be in the reviewers. And so it came back into the bill with the new language. So that is what happened in local government. And so otherwise it was going to be out of the bill. But there was an agreement not to take it out of the bill completely, but to leave it in with this language.
But, Madam Chair, you said it was a compromise, and I didn't see any of the union representatives saying they agreed with it. So I don't know who you compromised with.
Well, nobody was completely happy because some people wanted it completely repealed, and some people didn't want it repealed at all. So it ended up staying in the bill with that exception.
Could we have some folks come and talk to us about their
certainly
objections?
And Mr. Carlson, as long as you're at the table, do you want to share your concerns?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to indicate on behalf of local governments that we do support this provision. Over the 8 years between 2001 and 2009, we have seen our cost for fringe benefits increase by 46%, a substantial percentage that just we cannot sustain given the fiscal environment that we find ourselves in currently with threats of cuts in our aids from the state, declining real estate values that makes it difficult for us to look to property tax increases to fund these costs. Just to briefly explain the amendment, I think Senator Higgins expressed a concern that it doesn't say upon expiration of the existing contracts. It says that explicitly in the effective date clause. So current law would continue to apply for the duration of existing contracts with every local government employer in the state. No changes could be made in employee health plans without the union's agreement. And so basically, the unions are now on notice that the next round, to the extent, again, as I said previously, they want to spell out copays, they want to spell out deductibles, they want to spell out the provider network, they can do that in the rounds of negotiations. I think in past testimony on this bill, union representatives have made the representation that this allows local governments to abrogate the terms of their contract. That's simply not true. The contract applies to them exactly as it applies to any other party to a contract. During the term of the contract, all the provisions stay in effect. It's further been stated that it eliminates collective bargaining for fringe benefits such as employee health care. Again, not true. The state's Public Employment Labor Relations Act explicitly provides that fringe benefits are subject to negotiation, and for the employer to fail to meet and negotiate on those subjects on a good faith basis is an unfair labor practice. So in the future, as this goes into effect, those subject matters are explicitly allowed to be subjects of negotiation. Madam Chair, you know, we have been caught in situations where, for example, in the handout that I've had distributed to the committee, where as little as a change that says, we won't change your benefits whatsoever. We just want to limit your provider network so we can limit the premium increase to 5% has not been allowed to occur because of the refusal of the unions to do so. As a result of that refusal and the specific situation in the West St. Paul School District, the increase more than doubled to 11.3%, and most of that increase was borne by the taxpayer. We've had a number of situations where most of the unions have agreed to changes in the health plans to deal with the rising costs that we collectively, as employers and employees, are facing, because employees do generally pay part of the freight on employee. Because of the refusal of one union, we have to get all their agreements because we have one health plan for everybody, not one health plan for every union that we deal with. We were not able to make those changes. So local government has constantly found itself stymied in dealing with rising health care costs. And we're just asking for basically the playing field to be balanced, that we're on an equal footing with the unions in future collective bargaining situations. Again, to the extent that the unions want to lay out the specific provisions of their health plan that they want during the term of that, they're free to do so during the negotiations. And again, this does not affect existing employee health insurance during the term of existing collective bargaining agreements.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I have a couple questions. Mr. Carlson, how many times do contracts expire before a new agreement is made?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, do insurance programs expire before the expiration of a collective bargaining agreement?
No.
Senator
Higgins. In the effective date, you're talking about existing contracts. Are those union contracts or are those health care or insurance contracts?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the reference is to this specific subdivision. The reference is to the collective bargaining agreements.
Okay. Senator Higgins. So how often does a collective bargaining agreement expire before the new contract is agreed to? I mean, they totally expire. I mean, they only have a certain date they go to, right? I mean, that's
yes.
Why you renew them.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I believe under state law, the term of a collective bargaining agreement can be from 1 to 3 years. So it depends on the specific contract.
Do you have any sense of maybe what percentage of contracts expire before the new agreement is made?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, I do not have a specific figure for you.
Okay. So then,
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, my other question, if my poor feeble brain can remember it. Oh, I know what it was. Usually when there's a, you know, when you're at the bargaining table, the way I understand it, if somebody brings in a new item that should be bargained, the other side either brings one in or, you know, there's some give and take that happens to make sure that this new item is brought onto the table. So who's bringing this one in, the employers or the unions? And what is the other side going to exact for that?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, that's exactly the situation that we're trying to address. Right now, under current law, the unions start out with the existing health care plan. They do not have to bargain for that whatsoever. Basically, under current law, the existing employee health insurance plan stays in effect into perpetuity or such time as the union gives notice that it wants to strike. So unlike other items that are usually at the negotiating table, they start from, we've already got this. We don't have to negotiate for that if that's the position that they want to take. That's distinguished from every other item that we bargain for. And so we're basically wanting to get to the point where both of us come to the table, where the employees or their union representatives can make one offer on, and the employer can make one another offer. Again, this is always an item of collective bargaining. For us to fail to bargain on those fringe benefits is an unfair labor practice.
Madam Chair, can we ask Senator Mr. Thorson or Mr. Thornton to come and talk to us about their opinions on this?
We certainly wait. We do have one other testifier. Are you Ms. Kushner? Okay. She had signed up to testify earlier.
Sometimes that doesn't work. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Kushner. I'm here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll be brief. We basically agree with everything that Mr. Carlson just said. With regard to counties, we have found the same situation with cities. I want to stress that everything I have done contract negotiations in cities in my past career. Everything remains bargainable. The unions can bring everything to the table, up to and including formularies for prescription drugs. We have union contracts in cities where the entire formulary has been bargained into the contract. So everything is still open for negotiation. This bill merely gives cities an opportunity to move forward with changes to health care plans. We've experienced the same things the counties have, where one union has held up the entire city from moving to a different type of health care plan and has said, no, we don't agree to this. Our cities, most of our cities, are way too small to have separate health care plans for each bargaining unit. It has to be the whole city sticking together with one plan, or they can't make it work. They're not big enough to do it separately. This has been a very big problem in a lot of our cities, and we would like to see it changed. We are, just like Mr. Carlson said, we aren't asking not to bargain on this. We're just saying, give us an opportunity. Give us a window of opportunity where we can bargain with the unions on this. Otherwise, everything just keeps rolling over year to year, and the city can't make any changes. Thank you.
Is there someone who would like to testify on the other side of the issue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. And this is a little bit confusing to me as well. But it appears to me that what labor unions are going to have to do after our collective bargaining agreements expire is bargain a clause in our contract that would allow us to bargain for our health care. And that just doesn't make sense to me. Our collective bargaining agreements typically run, as it was stated in previous testimony, from 1 to 3. You know, it's a one-year contract, or it's a three-year contract, or it could be a two-year. Well, anyway, 1 to 3 years. But health care is an annual thing. We have to bargain for that every year. And if we don't have it spelled out in the contracts, and very few contracts do have it spelled out, every piece of it, usually it's just the percentages of who pays what. So every year it would be off cycle if you had a three-year contract. You'd have to come back every single year to bargain for your health care. And that just it just doesn't make sense to me. It seems to me that we're going to have to, first of all, put a clause in our contracts to bargain to be able to bargain, and then we're going to have to bargain every year and have every piece of the health care in our contracts. And that just seems very cumbersome to me.
Any questions for Mr. Thornburg? If not, would you identify yourself, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with AFSCME Council 5. The I'd like to echo what Mr. Thornburg said and also ask the question, I mean, when is a contract not a contract? And that is when one party can unilaterally make changes to that contract. Now, when in collective bargaining process, what happens is both the employer and the employee groups monetize the value of the entire agreement. How much is going to be devoted to wages? How much is going to be devoted to health benefits? And agreements are reached based on that. What this would allow, this change in law would allow, is the employer, after that agreement is reached, to be able to make changes to the health care part of it. The agreement was reached with all that being together. And current law right now states that the change in aggregate value of the benefits, only if there's a reduction, must be negotiated with the union. So in other words, if the union and the employer sit down and reach a collective bargaining agreement for wages, hours, conditions of employment, fringe benefits, only if there's reduction in part of that agreement. And the health plans, right now, our local government's required to renegotiate that with the unions. And, again, I think it preserves the contract as a contract under current law.
Are there any questions for Mr. Thorson? Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't think there's a question for the testifiers. I guess what I'm trying to get square here now, what this bill does is allow for the collective bargaining to work after the 2 year or whatever it is. It's kind of like zero-based budgeting, isn't it? See, what I think I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I think I'm hearing from these testifiers is they have something at this level and they want it to stay at that level forever and ever. But this bill does then say that after the collective bargaining period, whether it be 1, 2, or 3 years, when we start the bargaining process again, we start new and fresh. Is that what the bill's doing? Or to me, that's how I read the bill, that it gives a fresh start, just like zero-based budgeting. We're going to come back to the table, and conditions and everything could change. So everybody has the same fair advantage because everything's new. And that's how I read the bill. Is that right? No?
No, it's not that extensive.
Oh.
It's just in this area, actually.
Well, that's what I'm saying, just in that little area.
Yeah.
Isn't that what it's doing?
It would be the way I'm understanding it, for example, is they would agree that if something came up with their health insurance, that they thought they might be able to do something different or better, that they could agree, for example, that instead of all five unions in that group having a veto authority, that maybe if three of them vetoed it, it wouldn't go anywhere, but you wouldn't need permission from all five. You could negotiate that. You could set that into the contract. I think that's what this could really be about, is that you wouldn't have to have all of the unions, which is that aggregate group, needing to agree. I mean, you could negotiate that. There's a variety of things you could negotiate on how it would be handled, but it wouldn't be simply as it is in current law, which is what you see after the new language. Senator Higgins.
I think it also sets in place a lot of instability in your health care benefit. If every year you have to find out from the employer whether you're going to have something similar to what you have now, or whether maybe they can offer three different plans and you get to choose. Well, maybe they're going to only have one. Maybe they're going to go to that strange high deductible low benefit thing. Maybe they're just going to say, I'm sorry, we're not going to have any. But every year you would be in a position where you'd have that instability in knowing what's ahead. And I think that when it comes to health care, anyway, we know that some sort of stability, some sort of ability to plan is good, especially if you have some sort of pre-existing health care condition, if you cover your children and they might have issues, knowing that you have coverage for them now and you might not in a year at the end of the next bargaining, makes it really difficult for families. And I think that this would become real problematic. And I know some people around the table like that high deductible, low benefit thing, but as an employee, I'd be really unhappy if my other employer did it to me. So that's kind of the way I see it, and I don't know if anybody else at the table sees it kind of some other thing, but it's the instability that really jumps out at me.
But Senator Higgins, it would still have to be collectively bargained. I mean, it could be, if they want to put terms on this, they might agree to leave it just like it is, or they might agree to some changes, but it allows them that opportunity. I think that's basically what it is doing. And Mr. Carlson, correct me if I'm wrong. It isn't saying that the employer will be able to do those things to the members. Senator Cruz?
Well, Madam Chair and members, let me take a stab at this. And I guess I'll start off with Senator Perry's comments and see if I can answer that first. I kind of see where you're going with it, but essentially what the legislation as written right now is attempting to do is say these aggregate benefits, which are, let's call them X factors, there are these healthcare benefits that are out there, call it the deductible or the premiums or those type of things. As law is written right now, those cannot be changed, even though they are not in the contracts. Okay? What is in the contract is either that percentage or dollar amount that is contributed by the employer. So what we're saying now is, okay, we would like the ability as a city or as a county to negotiate those aggregate benefits, because those are factors that are out of our control and are a huge piece, especially in difficult economic times, of managing our resources. Managing resources to the extent of, especially if you get some larger groups of employees, if you can't account for those, could potentially result in layoffs, which we don't want to see happen. So essentially what this legislation is saying, okay, these aggregate benefits, if you want those to be locked into these collective bargaining agreements, then let's negotiate those. We're not just going to automatically in statute say that they can't be changed, because the fact of the matter is they do change. And then if I could, and I hope that answers your question a little bit, Madam Chair, as well. And if not, we can bring Mr. Carlson back up. Definitely. But I did want to address what Senator Higgins said as well. Respectfully, Senator Higgins, I think there is the potential that some of these things could change a little bit. There is. But I would argue that that's what folks in the private sector are dealing with every day. And it's those type of things, those fluid movements, that ability to kind of work with those changes that allow our private businesses to be successful, because you have to be able to manage those costs. And I would argue this is part of that, especially right now as we're making difficult decisions as far as local government aid is concerned and county aid is concerned, and everybody's really feeling this pinch right now. So what the goal of this is not to leave anybody out in the cold, not to hurt anybody. I have nothing but respect for our union folks, our firefighters, our police officers. I can't tell you how much I value them, because I really do. But the fact of the matter is, everybody's going to have to kind of play a part in this. Everybody's going to have to kind of share it. So respectfully, yes, there is the chance that some of these things could change, but I would say that that's a necessity of the environment that we're in right now.
Mr. Thorson?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with all respect to Senator Cruz, and I don't think Mr. Carlson intended to give folks the impression that these benefits cannot change through the course of an existing contract. They can. If it's going to be a reduction in the aggregate value of benefits to the employee group, they need to be bargained with the union. And so that's, you know, the aggregate value being the monetary value of what the plan was. So if there's going to be a change in the plan that's going to require additional out-of-pocket costs from the employees, then that kind of change needs to be negotiated with the unions in between the bargaining sessions. Those kind of changes happen all the time through labor management committees, through multi-union labor management committees. In the city of Minneapolis, there's 35 bargaining units that get together and meet annually with the employer to make those kind of changes and make those kind of agreements and sign off on them. Because the healthcare market is a dynamic market. Point is, and if the employer were to go out and get a better deal, one that decreased the cost of the health plan for the employees, there's no need to negotiate that if it doesn't change, if there's not a reduction in the aggregate value of the plan. So nothing prevents changes being made to the health plans. It's just that if after a bargained agreement, and again, when decisions were made dollar for dollar about where do dollars go with wages, where do dollars go for health benefits, if there's going to be a reduction in the health benefit side of that, of the aggregate value, you can move things around within that dollar amount. Under current law, it needs to be negotiated, and I think, quite frankly, that is in the spirit of collective bargaining, not changing a portion of that that was decided when it was static at the table.
Madam Chair, I think there are a couple more people who want to testify.
No, Senator Higgins, this is the Finance Committee, and I don't know that we need to go too much deeper into the weeds. I think people are starting to get an understanding of this. I need to keep these comments very brief.
All right, I'll just do it on the floor then. We'll talk about it a lot then.
Well, I'll let them come up. But I just don't know how many, you know, this discussion was occurring in local government.
And I don't get to serve on that anymore. So, Madam Chair, it is, I think it's complicated. I mean, it just looks like a nice little phrase that you stuck in the beginning of a sentence, you know, like to the extent that, you know, things are specified in a contract. But it isn't just that simple. It is a complicated thing, and it has huge effects on employees all over the state, and I think we should really know what the heck we're doing.
Well,
so that's my point, Madam Chair. If you want to go on, you know you're the chair.
Well, Senator Higgins, it was originally eliminated as a repealer, and we did think that this was a compromise, and it still lets them work with their employers on this language, and so I understand that they don't like it. And we, you know, if some more people want to come up and tell us why that, I invite them to the table.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for letting us speak before the committee today, and I promise to be brief. My name is Matt Toburin. I represent SEIU Local 284, the Union of Public School Support Staff, and also speaking on behalf of the Teamsters 320, as well as the Minnesota School Employees Association, to speak in opposition to this. And just want to be clear that what you're being asked to grant would be a convenience to the local governments and could have significant hardships on the employees and their families who rely on this health care. And I just want to sort of give you just a brief real-life experience to see sort of how this would work in real life. So currently, as the law states, a two-year contract is negotiated that has the aggregate value of health benefits. if 1 year into that contract something needs to change that would reduce that value, then, as was previously mentioned, there's labor management committees that work on these, and these changes happen all the time. The changes are constantly being made. What this would allow is that for the employer to make these changes unilaterally. Now, in a real-life example, so we have lunch ladies, food service workers, whose entire paychecks go to health insurance, their entire paychecks. And so they are signing on to a 2-year contract knowing that they need to organize their lives around the fact that this health insurance plan they have and that their entire paycheck is going to and is going to cover their family, whoever else it covers, that this is what they have. Now, what this change in language would do would allow, a year into that contract, the employer to, say, go to a high deductible or change the plan in a way that could significantly affect the insurance that these employees currently have, and that would not need to be negotiated over or renegotiated. The second thing that was sort of mentioned was an expiring contract. Now, the issue there is...
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, I don't see where in this language that you would conclude that, because when I read the language, what I read was that it would be only open for renegotiation after the contract was complete. So can you please show me in the language where you...
Health care is every year. Contract expires.
Well, and Senator Bonner, I'm confused, too, because...
That's not what she said, though.
It's only to the extent specified in a collective bargaining agreement. It may not ever be agreed to that would be the outcome.
Madam Chair, the issue there would have to specifically state in the contract that a year into the contract you cannot go to a high deductible or you can't change the policy provider. If you don't specifically state that, then those reductions can be made as long as any of those items are not specifically stated in the collective bargaining agreement. And I can tell you that almost no collective bargaining agreements have detailed descriptions of the policy provider and the doctor network and all this and that. And there are districts that we negotiate with that specifically have in contract language the right for the district to make changes. And I have some examples of that in a contract, and this is direct wording out of a contract. The selection of the insurance carrier and policy shall be made by the district. So in those instances where the district has deemed that this is an important issue for them, they can put that in the contract. And we can't argue that because the language is in there. So if this is that important to the local governments, there's nothing stopping them now from putting what they want into their contract. But what they're asking for a change is that every specific thing about the health insurance plan be covered under that contract. And the other issue with the expiring contract is that, so most of our school contracts end June 1st. We have a lot of contracts that are open. They're not going to be settled by June 1st because they're all doing their work trying to actually get the school year finished. So it might be a month, a couple months into the summer. What this would then allow the district to do, and not saying that they would do it, but what they would allow them to do is to say, after the expiration of your contract on June 1st, we will not offer you any health insurance whatsoever unless you specifically stated in your collective bargaining agreement that they had to offer some sort of health insurance post the ending of a collective bargaining agreement. So that's just some of our issues with why we oppose this bill. And I thank you for letting us have the time to say that today.
Madam Chair, committee members, Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. I see some familiar faces around this table. We just want to go on the record as opposing this, and I will not belabor the points that have been made already as far as why we do, but I want you to know that we're very concerned about this. A couple thoughts. Matt talked about some of the situations that could arise if benefits change midstream. And one of the supporters of the bill, I think it was Mr. Carlson, mentioned that one of the things that could change, for example, would be providers or networks, network providers. Now, for someone who may be in the middle of treatment, I just want to point that out because we're talking about real people and changes that can impact real people. So if I believed when I got into the contract that my network included doctors A, B, and C, and I happen to be unfortunate and I need one of those doctors, maybe I'm in the midst of chemo, and midstream, we want to change the provider network. That is very significant. If I'm lucky enough and I don't need to have a specific doctor for a very acute situation, I may not care. But we have those situations, and we know that that comes up. So I just want you to think of that. Also, think about the time that it's taken this committee to figure out exactly, one, what are the problems and what are we trying to fix? I think this is looking for a problem. And so now imagine, as Matt pointed out, if in the negotiation process they have to try and come up with everything that they think could change or that they don't want to change, how complicated and time-consuming that negotiation process will be. So with that, committee members, Madam Chair, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and I did not serve on that committee that you were referring to, but when the bill was brought to the previous committee, was this section just listed in the repealers? Was that the status of the bill at the time?
Senator Hahn, it was.
And that was the way the bill was originally drafted?
Yes, it was.
And is it the... Are the testifiers arguing to have the bill restored to the original condition of the bill and just put this into the repealer section? Is that the...
No, Senator Hahn, they would like to leave the language as it has always been in statute. Okay.
So my understanding is that just to put it in the repealer would it not make any difference, or would it be worse? Or, I mean, you've described this as a kind of a compromise. I'm just not... hearing that it's a compromise, and since it's so complicated, maybe simpler just to move it into the repealers. If that's the, I mean, I'm just trying to understand what the opponent's point is, that this is truly no different, then why do we not just put it back in the repealer?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, if you repealed it, you would repeal the existing language that would say that the aggregate value of the benefits shall not be reduced and whatever all. That's significantly different than what the testifiers would like, which is to take it out of the bill.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I understand that. What I was led to believe that there was that concern about repealing this, and so rather than repeal it, there was an attempt to try to craft language that would modify the effect of just repealing it. But it doesn't seem to have made any difference, and that's why I'm just saying, because it's complicated, maybe it would be better just to put it back into the repealer section, since it's not going to win any, you know, support from the people who don't like it in the first place. So that was my point, is whether it would be, just for sake of understanding, easier just to repeal the whole section. That was my point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Senator Hahn, I don't think that repealing the section does anybody any good. But I think the language that's in Section 7... the new language, I should say, if it is as complicated a change as it sounds like, perhaps the right language isn't in there, or perhaps it shouldn't be amended. I think repealing it doesn't help anybody except, well, I won't go there. Repealing it is the wrong move, and yet, you know, this was supposed to be some compromise language, but like I said earlier, I don't know who you compromised with, because I haven't heard anybody except Mr. Carlson say that it will do any good.
Well, so. Senator Higgins, what Senator Hahn said, we could remove it, which was what was originally requested by the local units of government. They'd be happier with it gone.
Well, I'm sure they would, Madam
And
Chair.
So it is something of a compromise. Because the collective bargaining units still have a chance to put language into their liking with this language. They can still negotiate that.
Well, and Madam Chair, that was my point, is that
I
wasn't in the committee, and I was going to ask Mr. Carlson if that was the way that they originally brought the bill, was to repeal the whole section of the law, and I understand that there was a controversy over that, but if what is done is not seen to be of any assistance, it would be a lot simpler just to put it back in the repealer. And I don't know what Mr. Carlson's opinion of that would be or others, but if it's creating confusion over how you interpret that and it doesn't seem to make any difference to the people who are opposed to the original proposal, why not just repeal the whole thing? I'm just asking, and it's not my bill, and I'm just but I don't know if Senator Cruz or Mr. Carlson has an opinion on it, but I thought that if there was an attempt to try to see that there was some things that could be done and let's try to accommodate that, and there was an effort to do that, and it's failed, I guess try to make it simple.
Madam Chair.
Senator Han.
Senator Han, are you assuming that because no one today talked about their disagreement with the concept of repealing it, that they aren't, that they would be happier with that than they would with this?
No, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, what I'm saying is it doesn't seem as if this language is any better than the repeal altogether, and so just to make it simple, just repeal it. Because I haven't heard anybody say, well, this is better than just repealing the whole section, even though they say it's complicated or it may not, you know, there's some debate over how you do that, but nobody has said, well, we think it was a little better than just repealing it. And I didn't hear that, so I was just saying, well, if it's complicated, people don't understand how it works, and they don't like it as much as they don't like repealing it, then why go forward with language that is complicated? Just make it simple and repeal it. I'm not trying to run the bill. I'm just asking the question.
Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, Senator Han, I'll be that person. Think it's better to leave this language in than repeal it. I actually didn't, my reading of it didn't have the same interpretation as those opposing it had, and so I'm going to, before it comes to the floor, do a little more investigation, a little more understanding of it. I think if somebody moved that amendment to repeal it, that probably would happen here, and I don't want that to happen, so I'm speaking up to keep this in there the way that it is.
Is there any more discussion on this part of the bill or any other part of the bill? Senator Cruz.
Well, just in conclusion, Madam Chair and members, please keep in mind this bill is not just about Section 7. We do have some other great mandate relief in here along with that that is really going to help our cities and our counties in a difficult time. And I would just appreciate you moving this onto the floor.
Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate File 874 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
As amended.
As amended.
Madam Chair.
There was one other thing. And Senate Council had made a suggestion on the language for the date of the effective date for Section 7. And maybe, Mr. Bonner, would you like to share that with us? Or do I have it here?
Madam Chair, I think it might require a little explanation, and I did talk about this a little bit with Mr. Carlson. When you look at the effective date on line 4.15, it's ambiguous, and I don't think it quite works. And what it needs is a date certain and to specify exactly how it applies to contracts that are in existence on that date. So if it is reworded to read, this section is effective July 1st, 2011, and applies to a contract in effect on that date, after the contract expires, I think that would be much clearer for the purposes of anyone trying to understand the law.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, if counsel could advise, the thing that I'm having some difficulty understanding is, do we mean the collective bargaining contract, which is one cycle, or do we mean any contract which includes, you know, I know with health insurance contracts, they generally are annual contracts. So are we talking about the collective bargaining contract, or are we talking about any contract, in which case the meaning does significantly change?
Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I think you're right. There is some confusion there as well. The subdivision refers to the group insurance contract. And I think Mr. Carlson might want to weigh in on that one, but it could be the effective date is intended to apply to the group insurance contract.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, the reference should be for clarity in lieu of to the term contract to collective bargaining agreement. This is consistent with the discussion in local government that existing law stays in effect for the term of existing collective bargaining agreements, and then those terms would have to be renegotiated upon the next cycle.
Well, Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, that was my interpretation of the way it should have been also, which is why I didn't agree with the opponents' concerns about the bill. So if there's some way that we could put that in there, I think that this bill would have a much smoother journey.
Mr. Bodden, do you have a suggestion for us?
Madam Chair, I can modify the effective date amendment that I suggested to you so that the effective date would read, this section is effective July 1st, 2011, and applies to a collective bargaining agreement in effect on that under this subdivision, in effect on that date after the agreement expires.
Mm. Say that one more time.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, maybe I can suggest a little simpler version of that. I would suggest this section is effective upon the expiration of collective bargaining agreements upon the effective date of this act. So the change in Section 7 becomes effective upon the expiration of collective bargaining agreements whenever the governor signs this into law. So if the term of those agreements runs for another year, another 2 years, if this section is of no effect once those contracts expire. I don't know if Mr. Bodden is comfortable with that.
Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair, I'd just point out this section doesn't have an immediate effective date.
Right.
And I don't think the bill has any appropriation in it, so the default effective date would be August 1st.
August 1st. Right.
So what would be the amendment?
Madam Chair, you may want to pick up again with what Mr. Carlson suggested. I think his way of wording it was somewhat more concise.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, this section is effective upon the expiration of existing of collective bargaining agreements in existence upon the effective date of this act. And I don't know if Mr. Bodden wants to still insert the July 1st in lieu of the usual August 1st.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bana.
There's still a question around intent with the way it's stated, because I think what would work best is if the collective bargaining agreement couldn't be tampered with during the period in which it's in force, so that this section's effect, do you know what I'm saying? So that you can't negotiate midterm, that once there's a collective bargaining agreement, previously the way it used to be worded is that you could never negotiate a change to the aggregate benefits unless it was agreed upon. What this bill now says is it's all negotiable. That's fine. I think that's the intent of the author. But I think the opponents are concerned that you could negotiate it at any point within the contract. And so I think the real compromise is to say, yes, it's negotiable, but once you've agreed to it for this 2-year period, you can't reopen that discussion until the 2 years is over. And so I'm still not certain with the way it's being stated now that accomplishes that.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
I think the problem is trying to put the expiration of the collective bargaining contract into the effective date.
Exactly.
I think if you want to do that, it belongs up in the paragraph someplace, and then the effective date becomes the effective date, which is August 1st or something. But trying to put the two together makes for a really complicated,
exactly,
kind of awkward and weird effective date. So. Mr. Bodden's rolling his eyes.
Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, what's commonly done with an effective date like this, where you're going to be affecting a variety of contracts, is to specify exactly how it applies to each of those contracts. And you would need to do that in the effective date language rather than what you're going to put into statute as it appears above. And then the other thing I would point out quickly is that it is making it clear that current contracts that are in effect would not be affected by the changes in this
right.
section until
yep.
they expired.
I understand.
Okay.
Well, maybe that sentence needs
Senator
to be
Higgins.
Just put in the regular paragraph.
But it's usually put in as an effective date on the bottom of the section. I think it's in the right place.
Madam Chair, if I were drafting the bill to begin with, that's where I would put it in the effective date.
Do we understand?
Are we meeting,
I guess we
when are we meeting again?
We have some time to. I mean, if it needs to be changed, Senator Cruz could bring that to the floor. Keep working on it.
Madam Chair, the other option is just let Mr. Bodern work on it, and we'll bring it back up at the beginning of the next meeting, which is in a day or two.
I would like to
You'd
move
like
the
it
bill.
To go away.
The agendas Great. Are long enough without carrying too many over it. Senator Cruz.
Well, just one, and maybe this will help, maybe it won't help, but I'm going to throw it out there, Madam Chair and members. What if we change the effective date just to simply say this section is effective upon expiration of existing collective bargaining agreements?
Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair, the only thing that is unclear about that is exactly what date you're referring to. When do those contracts exist? That's why you need to supply a date like July 1st or August 1st, the contracts that are in effect on that date when the bill would take effect.
Right. Okay. I think the language that we have, not in front of us, but has been stated.
Okay.
Is probably as close as we're going to get to perfect right now, but maybe not perfect. So Senator Higgins.
So, Madam Chair, it says something like this section is effective upon the expiration of collective bargaining agreements that are in effect as of pick a date.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. August 1st, 2011.
August 1st or what?
Yep.
July 1st, what were we looking at?
Well, it'll be August 1st.
August 1st.
Madam
August 1st.
Chair,
the rest of the bill.
Senator Higgins, the problem with wording it that way is it could be interpreted to mean that the section doesn't become effective until all of those agreements have expired. I think you want the section to take effect in law and then specify that it cannot apply to the individual contracts
until
each of them has expired.
Okay, let's say it that way. This section is effective August 1st and applies to... or something like that,
contract
or a second section,
collective bargaining
or a second sentence. It applies to.
I can take a stab at rewording it, or it could be a floor amendment.
I think that we could just leave it like this and bring in the floor amendment later.
Madam Chair, we'll do that.
I wish I hadn't brought it up. We just wanted to make it clear. When we didn't want to have it affect existing contracts, we wanted to make sure that was clear and to have a start date of when that started to apply. But we will get the language for it and then take care of it later. Okay. Are there any other questions about the bill? And Senator Perry has moved Senate File 1260. All in favor of that motion? Oh, as
amended.
As amended.
As amended, yes. So Senator Perry moves Senate File 1260 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, members. And Senator Nino, Chair.
This is really bad handwriting.
Next we'll have up Senator Limmer, who has been patiently waiting. He will be taking up Senate File 874.
Bring up the phone.
Yeah, I like
that. Senator Limmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad I could stay here and listen to that stimulating conversation preceding me. Senate File 874 makes some changes to informa pauperis proceedings. Some of you may know what informa pauperis proceedings are. That's when an individual who's financially unable to pay court fees in a civil trial, as well as their costs, or have payment of fees and costs waived by the court. It's similar to seeking a public defender. If you can't afford one, one would be appointed to you. In Minnesota, we have a similar proceeding for those who may not necessarily be able to afford legal fees and court costs and attorney fees. We do make provision if you qualify. Sometimes the circumstances of that particular individual may change, and sometimes it changes during the time of a court proceeding. at least a stretched out one. This bill makes a few changes. If the party is or becomes able to pay all or a portion of the fees and costs determined during the time they're before the court may order a payment of a fee of $75 or reimbursement or a partial payment of all or a portion of those amounts to be paid as directed by the court. It's rather straightforward, and then, of course, any fees or payments would be transmitted to the court administrator and then eventually to the general fund. But that's only in the event that the court determines if there has been any change in the status of the individual, financial status. The bill is before you.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, so is this, for example, if somebody does not have funds, they're in some kind of court proceeding, they've been determined that their costs would be paid for at public expense, and they win the lottery, then the court could say, well, all right, now we can refigure this, and maybe you have to pay some or all of your court costs.
Senator Limmer.
Well, that would be a unique circumstance, but yes, that would be one of those things. Or let's say the person was a long time unemployed, and during a lengthy court trial, this individual got a job. And it was a well enough paying job, and if the court could determine that they might require a part of their legal costs to be paid by that individual.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Limmer, what I was trying to also, by my question, is get at, if the person is involved in some kind of a civil proceeding in which there were the possibility of reimbursement coming, but would that be a consideration in this? In other words, if I don't have any money but I'm in a court proceeding where if I win my proceeding I gain money, would that also be one of these circumstances that would permit the court to collect fees in that event?
That I don't know. I can't tell you. Okay. I don't know.
Do you have a question? Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll weigh in on that question. And it would seem to me that under the wording of this language that the court would be able to intervene, you know, if for some reason the party came into money, the answer would be yes. The court would be able to entertain that and assess costs for that person after the action had been commenced.
And members, you notice on the note that we've received that it generates, presumptively anyway, some revenue. Senator Perry, are you going to want to
This is such a good revenue-generating bill, I would move Senate File 874 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Senator Perry moves that Senate File 874 be recommended, passed, and sent to the floor. Senator Cohen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, just one question. Obviously, with the generation of fees, most of that's been redirected to the court budget. This directs it to the general fund. Would you anticipate, as chairman of the committee, that if you look at what might be anticipated through something like this, that you would then generate that in your budget, in future budgets?
Senator Limmer.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, I get a little nervous when we have judges that may generate monies and then it would be generated directly to the court. And the reason why it goes to the general fund is to have a little bit of a separation.
Senator
for that purpose, Cohen. Am I understanding your question correctly?
Yeah, I think so, Mr. Chairman. Senator Limmer, but obviously, you know, what you know from chairing the division is that what we've done historically is if we take the $320 filing fee, you've been utilizing that in promulgation of the court budget. You haven't directed that to the general fund for usage by higher ed. So the courts have done that for years. I just wonder if you see this distinguished in any way in that respect.
Senator Limmer.
I don't think so.
Senator Perry has moved the Senate file to be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The bill is sent on the floor.
Thank you, members.
Members, I'm told we'll probably meet again on Wednesday, so watch your email. The committee is adjourned.